Exodus chapter 20, verses 18 to 26, and a discussion of the nature of law. The 22nd talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on March 5, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 20, Exodus 20, verses 18 through 26, accompanies this talk.
So last week I did a overview of the first half of Exodus, and then we looked at the Ten Commandments quickly. This week what I would like to do is answer, three or four questions last week. I would like to respond to those. And then I want to finish out chapter 20. There are just a few verses left, but I want to finish out that chapter. And then I want to talk about the nature of the law in general, because next week we'll start looking at the laws that are given. There'll be three chapters of laws that follow this, that follow chapter 20. And I want to talk about the nature of law in the Old Testament in general. The first question was with respect to the fifth law, the law to honor your parents. And the question was, shouldn't that be one of the laws that's dealing with interpersonal things rather than our relationship to God? Now, just to give you a little, so you understand what that question is, what I argued is that in the Old Testament, it seems in the Ten Commandments, it would appear that we've got two kinds of commandments that are given there. One is commandments that deal with our relationship to God, and the other commandments are with respect to people's relationship to other human beings. And that Jesus, when he was asked to sum up God's laws, he summed it up in that way. He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, and the second commandment is similar to the first, and that is to love your neighbor as yourself. So that seems to be a division in the Ten Commandments that is intended, intentional, and it's there for us to observe. And so the question was, and I argued that the first five all have to do with our relationship with God, and the second five have to do with our relationship with one another. But the question was, shouldn't the sixth one actually be, the fifth one, honor your parents, shouldn't that actually be our relationship to other human beings? And there's no reason why the division can't be four and six rather than five and five. There's no reason that it has to be symmetrical that way. My thinking as to why honor your parents should be with respect to our relationship to God is because I think that there is a principle that's buried in that commandment, and that is respect for authority, and that authority ultimately derives from God. And so there's a sense in which that commandment is with respect to our relationship to God. But I started thinking about it more, and the more I thought about it, the more it became clear that all of the commandments, you could say the same thing of all of the commandments, that behind them, ultimately, is the question of whether we are interested in being obedient to God or rebellious against God. So if you're going to look down below at the principles involved and the root principles involved, they're all going to get there. And the distinction between commandments dealing with our relationship with God and commandments dealing with our relationship with other people, that's going to disappear. So if we're going to maintain that distinction at all, then we have to be looking more at the surface act. And from that perspective, then the fifth one should be interpersonal rather than our relationship to God. So I've changed my mind. I think that makes more sense. Another question was about the third commandment. You should not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And the question was, could that be like when a woman takes the name of a husband, that there would be an association there, and that that you would do something that would kind of nullify or bring dishonor to God by that association? My understanding of this commandment is that it means, the wording means, don't misuse the name of God. And at the time in which we're speaking, the most common way in which the name of God was used was with respect to making oaths. That I would swear, I will gladly pay you Tuesday. If by God, I will gladly pay you Tuesday. So you are swearing and using the name of God, and the understanding is, if I don't, then God will punish me. So that seems to be the most common situation in which it was used, and I think that that's probably what's in view here. And in so doing, then, to swear and swear by the name of God, may God punish me if I don't do X, there's a sense in which one is using God, on the one hand, using his good, his position, and there's another sense in which it's not taking God seriously. That is, if you aren't taking the oath seriously. And I think that's what's in view, is an oath that's not taken seriously. And notice that in that verse, it says, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. And that's an appropriate ending if the context, if the scenario that's in view is one in which I am making a promise, by God I will do this, but I'm not taking the punishment seriously, that there is punishment attached to my faithlessness with respect to my promise. And what God is saying is, punishment is coming. You may think that you can disregard the oath that you have taken, even though you've taken it in my name, but punishment is coming. So I think that that's the scenario that's in view, and that's what the commandment is directed towards, but it certainly has a broader application, and that is taking God lightly, generally. Just as a side comment, the two ways that this commandment is often taken is not to swear using God's name, and then the Jewish version of that is not, you don't use God's name at all. That's why they don't use the name Yahweh at all, for fear that they might be abusing the name. They might do something that would abuse the name. But if the commandment is really directed against taking God lightly, then avoiding those two things isn't going to help you. You can still take God lightly without even mentioning his name or without swearing. The third question had to do with coveting. And it was raising the issue of, isn't asking us not to covet too much to ask? That, and what I argued is that is the last commandment. But when you get down to all the other commandments have to do with more with acts that you can observe, generally speaking. But the last one is coveting. That's an internal matter that can't be observed from the outside. But when you get to that last one and you see that coveting is prohibited, it really casts a light on all of the previous commandments. That even the intention behind those acts that have been prohibited before is precluded, it's wrong. So coveting or lusting is being condemned by the last commandment. And so the question was, isn't that too much to ask? Is it not the case that as human beings, our automatic response to a wide variety of situations is to covet or to lust? And I think the answer to that is yes. I mean, that is our automatic response. But just because that is our automatic response, could it be that that's still being prohibited? Is it possible that God is indeed prohibiting it? And the other question is it truly automatic, and can it not be avoided? I think covetousness and lust, I think, are largely automatic, that is our natural response. That is what we do as human beings. But I say they're largely automatic because there's a sense in which it's not entirely automatic. Covetousness and lust are, to a certain extent, habits that can be either fostered or they can be resisted. They aren't entirely out of our control. I was thinking about this over the week and thinking about an experience that I had when I was in high school that I haven't thought about for a long time. I had some friends that they weren't real close friends, but they were friends. And for a period of several weeks, I spent a lot of time with them, and all boys. And they had the habit of critiquing the anatomy of girls who walked by in the hallway. And it was usually after lunch that I was with them. And they did it constantly. Constantly. That's what they did. And that was not my habit. But after I had spent a lot of time with them, what I recognized is when I was away from them, I had picked up the habit, and I would start doing that. And for reasons unknown to me, I decided that was probably not a good practice, and stopped spending quite so much time with them. But that kind of thing is, to a certain extent, a habit that can be either fostered or it can be resisted. And there are lots of things like that. I mean, pornography is there is a habitual aspect to that. It can be either fostered or it can be resisted. And I never developed the habit of pornography. I was always afraid of it. And I am so thankful that I was always afraid of it because that's the kind of thing that can develop into a habit that is really hard to control. And there are other such things. So is covetousness, lust, are those habitual? To a large extent, they are. But they aren't completely out of our control, that those habits that get developed. The other thing that I would say is the automatic response may be largely out of our control, but then how we respond to that response is not out of our control. That we can always stand back and critique our automatic response and decide whether that was good or whether that was bad, whether that's something to be encouraged or something that is to be discouraged. And that, it seems to me, is, at least in my life, that is what a lot of my mental time is spent doing, trying to figure out, did I respond correctly? And if I didn't, how should I have responded and why? What would be the appropriate response and why would that be the case? And then repenting when I have responded wrongly, even if it was automatic. So those kinds of responses are largely out of our control, but I don't think that they are completely out of our control. Would God prohibit us from doing something that's largely out of our control, even completely out of our control? And I think the answer is yes, he would be willing to prohibit us from doing those things. I heard a preacher when I was in Israel this last time, I heard him give a sermon, and he made a comment that really has stuck with me. He said, repentance is a lifestyle. And I think that's largely true. That's very important. That is, the life of a believer is coming to recognize what kind of creature we are and how deeply embedded in us our sin is, and then going before God and asking for his forgiveness. And it's something we do all the time. And we need to do it all the time. Keep going back and say, I did it again. Please have forgiveness on me. And it's fighting against that deeply entrenched sin, those behaviors and attitudes. That's the only way that we're going to really understand how much a part of us it is. If you don't fight against it, you don't realize how bad it is. It's like the addict, the alcoholic, who drinks not because they're addicted, but because they like it. Well, they will never know the depth of their dependency on that alcohol unless they're fighting against it. And that's the same with respect to our relationship to sin. As I was thinking about this, and especially when I was thinking about my experience when I was in high school, it just struck me how much it is the case that the Ten Commandments is a societal project. That to the extent that society embraces those values, it instills that in all of us to a certain extent. We all have an impact on one another, whether that's for better or for worse, but we all have an impact on one another. And we are either impacting one another and encouraging them to embrace that which is true, or in the opposite direction. And Plato in Laws makes a very interesting observation. He says, he just makes this observation that in all of the Greek city-states, that they all have laws against adultery, but it happens all the time. The laws don't do anything. They don't really control that behavior. He says, but in all of the city-states, not a single one has a law against incest, but it never happens. Why? Because adultery is actually not considered by society to be all that wrong. It's winked at. But incest is considered to be unthinkable. And that's passed on to the next generations. And his point is that we have cultural taboos that are things that you just don't do. And nobody even thinks of doing that. It's just not done. And taboos can be good or bad, depending on whether it's a taboo that supports the right kind of values or not. But I was just thinking of my experience in high school. That was a time, so we're talking late 60s, that was a time when all of the taboos in our society were being torn down. And there was probably some good in that, but there was a lot bad in that. And that's too bad. But the culture either supports good values or it detracts from good values. It's largely a cultural thing, a communal thing. Not entirely, but the communal aspect is significant. Now, it's important to understand that in that kind of environment, you aren't necessarily creating righteousness, because there's compliance, outward compliance with these things. The kind of compliance that brings social acceptance isn't the same thing as righteousness. But it does make a society that is more orderly and one that's more comfortable to live in. Okay. I'm just going to make a couple of random comments about the Ten Commandments before I jump back into chapter 20. One thing is, interestingly, there is not a set presentation of the Ten Commandments. We only have two presentations of it in the Pentateuch. One is here in Exodus, the other one is Deuteronomy. They are not exactly the same. They are almost the same, but not exactly the same. There is one other old, and I'm not sure how old it is, but an old version of the Ten Commandments that has been found. And it is different from both the one in Exodus and the one in Deuteronomy. So it would appear that the Ten Commandments were not passed down as a memorized set thing. The second thing is, there is disagreement as to how to number the commandments. The Jewish culture tends to number them differently than does Protestant culture. The other thing is, the commandments appear to start with the most grievous of wrongs, and then it works down towards the lesser grievous. So, for instance, the first one, "You shall have no other gods before me," that is more severe than even seven, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain." And so I think that that's intentional, that it starts out with the more grievous and works down to the less grievous. If that's true, we'll come back to the fifth one. Not honoring your parents would be more grievous than committing murder. And we'll see next week that the punishment for both of those is death. Okay, let's look at Exodus 20, verse 18. "And all the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. Then they said to Moses, 'Speak to us yourself, and we will listen. But let not God speak to us, lest we die.' And Moses said to the people, 'Do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you, and in order that you may fear him. I'm sorry, in order that the fear of him may remain with you, so that you may not sin.' So the people stood at a distance while Moses approached the thick cloud where God was." So the scene is, remember, they're at the foot of Mount Sinai. They arrived there, and for 3 days they prepared for God to present to them the terms of this agreement that they are going to make with God. And so when the 3 days were up, there is thunder and lightning and trumpet sounds and smoke, fire on the mountain. And then God apparently speaks the Ten Commandments. So it audibly gives the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel. Clearly, this was a frightening event. They are scared, having heard God speak to them. They trembled and stood at a distance And then they make this request. They say, no more of this. We can't take it. This is too frightening. They say, let not God speak to us, lest we die. And they want Moses then to be their intermediary. So it's at their request then that Moses becomes this intermediator between them and God. Moses says to them, don't be afraid. God has come in order to do two things. One, to test you. And the second is in order that the fear of him may remain with you so that you may not sin. The first of those, to test you, that comes up in Deuteronomy, and I think it's a little bit clearer there exactly what that testing is. It's Deuteronomy 13, 3 and 4. I'll read it to you. This is with respect to a different test, but I think that it's a similar kind of testing. Verse 3, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet. So this is if a false prophet comes to you, or that dreamer of dreams. It says, for the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall follow the Lord your God and fear him, and you shall keep his commandments, listen to his voice, serve him, and cling to him. I think that the purpose for the testing that is talking about in Exodus is essentially the same, to see if they love God. And in order that the fear of him may remain with you so that you may not sin. I find this interesting, that what's being stressed here is that God would be, that they would see that God is so frightening that they wouldn't sin. I am always reluctant to use fear of God as motivation for people to not sin. If we talk about fire and brimstone, I've always avoided talking fire and brimstone because it seems to me that it's better to emphasize the love of God and what there is to what God offers us. But I think that I'm out of balance. The prophets do not shy away from talking fire and brimstone, talking about the punishment to come, the awesomeness of God and the wrath of God as being a motivating factor. And I find that interesting, and I think that it's a good corrective to me. And I think my leanings are all largely come from our culture, and our culture would shy away from that kind of motivation. But it is a reality that God is going to punish sin. That's a reality. And it ought to be a part of our calculation and thinking about things. Okay. So then Moses goes into the cloud, and let's remember that, the cloud, because the cloud's going to show up a number of times in the rest of Exodus, and I think it takes on a significance. He's going into the cloud where God was. The last few verses. Then the Lord said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. You shall not make other gods besides me, gods of silver or gods of gold, you shall not make for yourselves. You shall make an altar of earth for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. And if you make an altar of stone for me, you shall not build it of cut stones. For if you wield your tool on it, you will profane it. And you shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed on it. This is a curious thing for him to put right here? Why is it that God is talking about this? He has just given the Ten Commandments in which idol worship is forbidden. So why is he bringing it up here? My best guess is that what God is addressing is the natural response of the Israelites to what has just happened. And the natural response on the part of the Israelites to what has just happened is to want to worship God. But how do they want to worship God? They're going to want to worship God the way gods are worshipped, the way they know that gods are worshipped. And so the impulse is going to be to imitate the practices of Egypt and the surrounding cultures. And God is emphasizing, I am the creator of the universe. I am the one true God, the transcendent God. I am not one of those gods that the Egyptians worship. And so there are some things that have to be different in order to keep that in perspective. And one of those is, don't make an idol to me. Don't make an idol of me, and don't worship that. That may be your inclination, but don't do it. And he points out, okay, so don't make idols, and then altars. They all made altars, and what God is saying is an altar is appropriate. Sacrifices, offerings are going to be appropriate, but this altar is going to be different. Instead of making it out of, making it a monument of nicely cut stones and with engravings and all that sort of thing, he wants this to be an altar made of uncut stones. And that's going to come up elsewhere in the laws. And I think the significance of that is you need to remember that this is not of your doing. You can construct an altar and you can make offerings, but this is not a religion of your doing. It's not a practice of your creation. This altar will be made of stones that no human being has carved. Those will be the stones that I made. We'll go into it. I think it's very similar to when David says he wants to make a temple to God. And God says, how are you going to make a temple for me? You can't. It's not to be made out by human beings. And that theme's going to come up elsewhere also. We can't do it. We can't worship God on our terms. We worship God on his terms. He's the true God. Now, it says that you won't have, don't make steps, but there will be a ramp to my altar that your nakedness may not be exposed on it. I'm not sure what's going on there. Apparently, it was common in the ancient world for the priests to perform their rituals naked. And it's probably in response to that it is said that they're supposed to go up a ramp instead of steps. It is the case that later on, the priests of Israel, they wear underwear underneath their garments, and apparently that was the first time that that was done, that underwear was used in the ancient world. And what's the significance of the nakedness? And the best explanation that I saw by a commentator was that this is all connected with what happened in the Garden of Eden, that Adam and Eve ate of the fruit, and then their response, their immediate response was, we're naked, we've got to have clothes on. Our private parts need to be covered. And there's something about that response that suggests that there's a close connection between our sense of shame and our most, our private parts. If that's the case, then what's being indicated here is that the shame, our sinfulness as human beings, needs to be covered or dealt with in order to serve on the altar. But that's my best guess, something along those lines. All right, then in chapter 21, it's going to start right into the commandments that God gives to Moses, and then he will then communicate those to the Israelites. And there will be three chapters of such commandments, and we will launch into those next week. But now I would like to talk about the nature of the law in more general terms. What's going on with the law? They've been given the Ten Commandments, but those commandments are not very detailed or specific. It says not to murder, but what's murder? And what is murder? What isn't murder? That's not spelled out. You aren't supposed to steal, but what's stealing and what isn't stealing? That's not spelled out. They're supposed to commemorate the Sabbath, but it doesn't explain exactly how that's supposed to happen. It says you're not supposed to work. Well, what's work and what isn't work? Those are all questions that are left unanswered by the Ten Commandments. So there just is not enough information there for the people then to live out those commandments. So the laws that come are all a partial response to that need. They are all there to fill out better what it is that God is requiring. But how do we make sense of those commandments? There are 613 commandments in the Old Testament, according to Jewish tradition. How are they supposed to make sense of these, of all of these laws, all of these commandments? I spent quite a bit of time working on this, but it was many years ago, and I'm going to summarize what I determined in the next half hour or so. But it was a long time ago, and I have kind of forgotten what needs to be said with respect to this, so we'll see if I can present this coherently. When I was looking at this, the typical response that I ran into is that people would say, you look through the Bible, and when you come across a commandment, then you decide, is that one that we need to follow, or is that one that we don't need to follow? One of the most common approaches was to divide the law into three categories. There is the religious law. There is social law or civil law. And then there is moral law. And you go through, and if a commandment is either of the first two, then you don't need to follow it. It's only if it's the third one, that is the moral law, that it needs to be followed. Another approach was similar, but it would just go through each commandment and evaluate them individually as to whether they were culturally bound or whether they were a universal law. And you look at the law, you look at each law, and you determine whether is this culturally bound. If it is, then you don't have to pay attention to it. If it is a universal commandment, then that's one that you need to follow. And every book that I read on it used an approach that was along those lines. And that whole approach did not sound reasonable to me. So I started thinking, what kind of an activity do we have in our experience, everyday experience, that would be similar to what God wants us to do with the Bible, that would help us to understand how we're supposed to deal with these commandments? And what I realized is the activity that we're all engaged in that's similar is a parent-child relationship. That a child is in the position of having to understand the commandments that are given by the parent. parent says, don't touch the wood stove. And the child has to figure that out. What's that mean? What all is involved in that? And what does it mean for me to obey that commandment? And in that process then, if you think about how that works, is you start out with your young children, and as a parent, you're teaching them. But what you have to teach them is very complicated. What you have to teach them is a whole system of what's right and wrong. But you can't start out with that. You have to start out with something that's simpler, that's something that's more accessible. So what we did is we made our house as childproof as possible. We made it so that our kids could touch and play with anything that was in their reach, pretty much. But there were a few things that it was not easy to get out of their reach. And so our policy was, on those few things, we are going to strictly enforce the rules. You can't touch the wood stove. It didn't matter whether they could understand why not. In fact, we couldn't wait for them to understand why not. They had to know that that was forbidden right now, whether they understood why or why not. And it was strictly enforced. And we even had the discussion, what about in the summer? Do we let our child touch the wood stove in the summer? And we decided, when they were really young, not even in the summer. Let's not confuse the issue. It's just off bounds, out of bounds. But as they get older, and when they can understand, then you can let them touch it in the summer. You can explain to them, no, you can touch it in the summer. It's only when there's a fire in there, when it's hot, that you can't touch it. So there's more sophistication that can slowly be introduced. But it has to start out really simple. As the child then grows in experience and understanding, now the commandments can be more sophisticated. They can be more nuanced, and more explanations can be used. The child then becomes this little scientist who's doing all of these experiments on their parent to figure out what they can do and what they can't do. And you've probably all seen this kind of situation where you tell your child you can't touch the television, and the child goes over and stands by the television and touches the side. What's going to happen? Is this part of the television? They touch the cord. Is this part of the television? They touch the stand that it's on. Is this part of the television? I mean, they aren't just being rebellious. There's a sense in which they're carrying out an experiment with you to see what are the lines here. What is it that I can do and what is it that I can't do? And they're getting information that's very important for them in trying to put together what it is that they're being asked to do. What it is that they are doing is they're taking all of this information and using it to construct a model in their mind of the way that their parent sees the world. It's a model of their parent's worldview. And they want to make it as comprehensive as they can make it. And that's going to include just data about the world, what the world looks like, what's good, what's bad. And not only what's good and what's bad, but a hierarchy of values. We all have a hierarchy of values within our understanding of the world. And some things are good, but other things are better and take precedence over this thing. And the child has to construct that whole thing. That's what they're doing. And the child, when the child is mature, the goal is the child would have a complete model in their head of how their parent views the world. And children create those models, and I'm sure you know that. They know which parent to go to ask for X and how to ask for X. And they're doing that because they've got this model that they can use that helps them to determine how their parents are going to respond. Okay. When I realized that this was an analogous kind of situation, it was very illuminating in my way of thinking about these commands in the Bible. And let me just give you a few of the implications, and then I hope to leave some time in case you have questions on this, because there's a lot to this. What this means, then, is that if you really think about it, nobody applies a command. I'll make it that bold. Nobody applies a command. You apply a worldview. So it's not a matter of looking at the commands in the Bible and seeing which ones you apply and which ones you don't apply. You don't apply any of them, in a sense. What you apply is the worldview that you construct on the basis of each of those commands. And that's very important. One of the implications of that, what a child does is they have to come up with a worldview that makes sense of every command that's been given to them. Why was that command given? What is in the worldview of my parent that would give rise to this particular command in this particular set of circumstances? So every command is important in building the model. But what's applied is the model that results from all of that analysis. And as I mentioned before, that world has to include this hierarchy of values that exists in everybody's worldview as a part of it. So what a child is going to do in constructing that worldview is they're going to use every bit of information that they can get. It's not only all the commands that have been given, but their observations of their parent, any instructions or teaching that their parent has ever given them, any dealings of their parent with another child. All of those are sources of information that can be drawn upon and need to be made sense of in view of the worldview that would give rise to all of that. It's a huge project, but every child does it. That means that all that information is critical for putting together that worldview. Okay. That also means that a commandment that's given in a point in time may not be applicable. It may not be a commandment that is to be followed in another circumstance. I'll use the example that I have used many times because that means I don't have to think of another example. If we had a rule in our house that our children could not play with the bat, swing the bat in the house, and our reasoning for that was we don't want something to get broken. If you want to swing the bat, go outside. There's less that you can destroy out there. If we had a fire in the house and our kids needed to get out, I would have wanted them to violate that commandment, don't swing a bat in the house. I would have wanted them to understand that there is a hierarchy of values in my head, that the things in the house are valuable and ought not be broken, but your lives are more valuable than the things in the house. And if the only way you can get out is to break the window by swinging a bat, I want you to do that. So that command that I gave, that was a general command of significant application. But what they need to understand is the whole worldview that gave rise to that, and apply the worldview and not just obey the command. I would want them to disobey that command under those circumstances. Another example, we had a rule that if we were crossing a street, our child had to take the hand of an adult. And that is a great rule for kids that are 5 and 6 years old. When my child's 30, that is not a command that I want them to follow. I mean, they can, but it doesn't need to be followed anymore. Because the situation is significantly different now. They've grown up enough that they understand what's at stake and all that sort of thing, and they don't need to hold my hand when they cross the street, etc. I mean, we could go on and on, and you can see what I'm talking about. So a command, strictly speaking, a command has a very short shelf life. It's only good for the instant in which it's given, and at any other time, it needs to be analyzed as to why was it given, and what's the worldview that gave birth to it, and therefore, how do I apply the worldview in this situation, which is different. Okay, so that's the way that I've come to look at this stuff, that what we have in the Old Testament is a series of laws that were given at a specific point in time to the people of Israel for the purpose of making them a people of God. And what we need to do with that then is to analyze that and figure out what is God's worldview that would make sense of these commands. And then when we've constructed that worldview, we can use that worldview to look at any circumstance, any situation in human reality and assess it and determine what we should do. That's in theory. Okay. Now, this is all assuming that this holds. That is, the parent-child analogy is indeed analogous to what God is doing with us. And I think that it is, with mankind, is what I'm, when I say us. God revealed his law, his worldview, over an extended period of time. Thousands of years it has taken for him to make that, to reveal that, and he's still revealing it, I would argue. He started with the most basic concepts. And in his dealings with Israel at this time in Exodus, I would argue he's dealing with the most basic concepts. That those concepts have to be put in place and become a part of people's thinking before he moves on to more sophisticated concepts and explanations. So our job then is to look at those and make sense of them and reconstruct what is the worldview that God must have that would make sense of this. Everything in the Bible then is relevant to that project. Even commands that are long outdated, they're relevant to this project because God made that command under certain circumstances. He's the same God. He has the same worldview. What gave rise to that command? Okay. If we take this approach then to the Old Testament law, then there is the possibility that we would find that any given command in the Old Testament, we would decide, oh, that's outdated. That doesn't hold anymore. God's worldview is such that in our circumstances, that's no longer necessary to do that. And one could go through all of the commands of the Old Testament and do that with them. You could decide they're all outdated. And as a result, what I'm advocating would be open to abuse. So is it open to abuse? Absolutely it is. I mean, that certainly someone could do that. The only solution, the only thing that would keep us from doing that is integrity. Please note that given that this is what we're doing, loopholes make no sense. We aren't looking at statutory law where we can kind of find a way to wiggle around the stated law. I mean, that's completely contrary to the project. The project is trying to figure out how God thinks about the world and therefore what would he want me to do. It's not to justify actions that would otherwise be precluded. So its integrity is what stands in the way of abuse. And it's only to the extent that there is integrity that there won't be abuse. Okay. If that's indeed a good analogy, and if that's what's going on, I find it inspiring and kind of exciting. When I think about, as a parent, what would I like for my children? And it's difficult because as a human being, I'm a sinner, and I can be wrong about things, and I fully acknowledge that. But to the extent that I am, that I understand the world correctly, and I embrace things that are good and true, I would love for all of my children to learn that and embrace it too. There is nothing that I would like better. As a believer, then, I'm doing a similar kind of thing with respect to God, that to love what God loves is to love God. That I love God so much that I dearly want to know what he values and what he doesn't value, what is right and what is wrong. And I want to incorporate that into my life. And so it becomes a wonderful picture for me of what this project is about, and one that I really like, I'm really attracted to. It's inspiring. Okay, so next week then, we'll start right into the laws. We're going to just march through the laws and talk about what it is that they are saying and what it is that God is requiring and why, as best we can. Okay, any questions, comments?
Thanks, David. I appreciate that. I want to go back to your comments, and I'm, this isn't so much a question as kind of teasing out a particular word that you use that I get stuck on. And you were talking about the 10th commandment and coveting your neighbor's wife, mm-hmm. and in the context of that verse and other property. And you said two things that I totally agree with, that coveting is a very human, automatic response, and that it's appropriate to resist that automatic response, and that God is asking us, I think, to resist that response. I think he probably threw in the 10th commandment because he knew it was an automatic response that should be resisted. I work with a lot of teenagers in detention settings and treatment programs, mm-hmm. currently, who have addictive behaviors and problems with substance abuse, generally speaking, and many of them show no interest whatsoever in resisting or changing their behaviors, and that is quite disheartening.
Yeah.
But from personal experience, I know that particularly growing up in kind of Christian evangelical circles, resistance took on this kind of pseudo-spiritual flavor that I found ultimately in my adulthood, looking back on that, to be an inadequate answer to addiction. You know, I'm gonna pray. I'm gonna go to accountability groups. If that doesn't work, then I need to learn how to pray differently or pray more. And I guess the reason I'm bringing this out in this room is because I never assume in a group of this many people that there might be somebody here listening to that who's gone through that or is going through that experience, and it can be quite disheartening and frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I have learned over the last number of years looking at that is that you can resist, but that often addictive behavior comes out of it's often a symptom of something else going on. I think most people who struggle with either substance abuse, substance addiction of one kind or another, sexual addiction, often engage in those behaviors because they want to feel normal. So when you say, somebody who drinks because they like it, there's a sense in which that's true in the same way that somebody likes feeling normal over feeling despair. You know, I'm going to choose drinking. I like to drink because I don't want to feel sadness. So I bring that up just to kind of tease that out and to bring it maybe a different, kind of come at it from a different angle. That I think there is a lot of times this kind of sense in Christian circles that, man, if I can just knuckle down, I can muscle my way out of sin. Mm-hmm. I've never found that to be the case. Mm-hmm. But I think there is hope for change, and I have found that in my life. I found that in working with others. But it often takes kind of teasing out deeper hurts and traumas from life. And that can require some help. So I just want to say that out loud.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that whatsoever. And my experience at Gutenberg is that addictions are becoming more common and of all kinds I did not imagine. And they can be very deeply ingrained. They're built, they come out of something that I'm not competent to analyze. And they're very complicated. And so I acknowledge all of that, absolutely.
I really appreciated the analogy that you made between the parent-child relationship and the relationship of God to, say, the Israelites or us in general. And I thought it was really helpful. Analogies always have, points where they work and points where they don't work. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to explore the developmental aspect of God teaching us in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, with children are not developed to the point where they are capable of thinking at a level that an adult can think,
right,
and analyzing and figuring out the whole car thing,
right,
and the street thing. Not the case so much with the adults in Israel, but there, it does seem like maybe, I don't know, that there is a developmental nature to the way that God is revealing himself, and I don't know exactly how to think about that. I mean, there's a sense in which God could have said, instead of giving you guys the law, let's sit down and have worldview classes. But obviously he didn't do that. So
right.
I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I have some thoughts about that because I have thought about that. That is interesting. And their minds are fully developed human minds. They can understand as well as we can understand. So there's a sense in which they are capable of putting together a model of God's worldview just as well as we can. But God seems to have chosen to unfold his, reveal what he's up to over an extended period of time. So societally speaking, they have less information. So God wants, it's as if society is a child that's growing up and it has to develop an understanding of concepts and stuff before we move on to more sophisticated ones. Even though the people that make up that society are fully competent. Do you see the distinction I'm making? That seems to be the way that God has decided to reveal things. He could have. They're fully human beings. They're smart people. He could have just sat down and talked with them. But he seems to have chosen, he wanted to lay a whole bunch of groundwork in history and in their experience as a society that he is going to build on instead of doing a worldview class.
Well, this worldview idea, part of it for us as believers, it's taking the whole Bible. We learn God's worldview from reading the whole thing and the history and all that. And I see often when people just take parts of it, take it out of context, then they're not looking at the whole worldview of God. They're just looking at little individual aspects, like sometimes confused children get, or parents who aren't consistent. You know, they get one thing or another. And I see that with people that are, I know some individuals I just met today, actually talked to today, they're taking certain things out of context, and they haven't really seen the whole worldview of God, which is a real danger when we don't really understand the whole Bible and look at the historical. And when people say the New Testament God's a different God than the Old Testament God, these kinds of things,
right,
they're not really looking at
right
the whole. So I appreciate your right concept that what we want to do is get to know who God is and his worldview, and then things fall into place
yeah
better.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But I have great sympathy for those people
mm-hmm
because it's a big and difficult job.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And
so to understand not just what is the context, but what's the relevant context.
Mm-hmm.
And what is God doing over time? What is history all about? That is a big undertaking, but it's really an important one.
And as Christians, if we're newer Christians, we don't have that full view of God, and we grow in our own understanding and develop our worldview too as we grow in experience and have more experiences of God.
Right, right.
So we're children in a very
right
real way when we
right
first come to know God.
And we've all got different
yeah
a different set data set that we're working from about who God is, because we've all had different experiences. And I would point out the Bible is critical in this process, but our own experiences are also critical in this process. That is also, there's a sense in which that's God dealing with us too, and it's revelatory. So all that stuff needs to be brought together. So it's a big project. Yeah. Okay. Thanks.